Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Tennessee.
We now join history repeating itself. Already in progress.
Radio 720.
This is the John Williams Show.
WGN.
Live Thanks, from sir. The 75th anniversary of the Scopes Monkey Trial.
I can't shut up. There's so many great stories to tell here. They're right. And, you know, I could tell some of them, but I'll tell you who told it perhaps better than anybody else. They acknowledge down here that one of the great works of literature and history about this event, the Scopes Monkey Trial, and all of the different facets that go with it is Dr. Ed Larson. He is the guy that wrote Summer for the Gods. And in 1998, a couple of years ago, his book won the Pulitzer Prize for History. He's sitting right here. Ed, nice to meet you. Congratulations.
Nice to be here. Why, great to be on WGN.
Why did you do this piece of history? Did you sense that this was a great debate, that this was great history?
Well, it's a great story, if nothing else. What it was it's the best-known American trial that ever occurred. More people have heard of this than anything else, and yet there'd never been a work of history about it. So I thought I'd rectify that situation, and I had an opening for myself.
What did you discover when you began to do the research?
I was able to get the original documents, sort of the original archival stuff that Brian and Darrow and the ACLU wrote about it at the time, so I could figure out exactly what they were trying to do, and therefore was able to make a little more sense about what actually happened down here to make this a legend.
Do I understand correctly, in the narrowest sense, this was a debate about a law and whether or not a school district or a state can dictate what is taught in the local school? And that seems reasonable. But on a bigger stage, it's about evolution and creation, right?
It's about both issues. Each tried to cast it their own ways. But what really caused this was a debate over the teaching of evolution, Darwinism in particular, naturalistic evolution in the public schools. William Jennings Bryan was very much opposed to that, and he crusaded for laws across the country to limit that. It just happened that Tennessee was the first state to pass such a law. Throughout, from the very beginning, the ACLU was fighting him, and when that first law passed, they ran an ad in all the papers of this state, Tennessee, inviting any school teacher willing to challenge that law in
really?
Court to have a test case. And that's what this was, a test case of that law, because Scopes himself had never violated the law.
He wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't out to make history, was he?
No, the town was. What it was the civic leaders here in town, this isn't Bryan country, this is Republican East Tennessee, they didn't like Bryan, they saw a chance to get some publicity for their town, so the school board president and the school and the superintendent of schools asked him to stand as a test case. He had never violated law, he wasn't a biology teacher.
Indeed, Rick Dye just made that point to us a moment ago, and so then he is found guilty at the trial, right?
Yes, he's found guilty. Because basically they never put him on the stand because he hadn't violated the law. Both sides wanted a clean test case, and if it come out that he hadn't violated the law and he got out on that reason, it wouldn't resolve the real issue.
Which was?
The real issue was whether a state should pass such a law. It was more a should than a could, because back then the Constitution, the federal Constitution, First Amendment, didn't apply to the state.
But
so it was an issue over whether a state should. It was sort of a debate over the rightness of such a law. Not the legality, but the rightness.
But all of the great theater, all of the pomp and the bombast in the courtroom was about religion. It was about, can you prove this science? Because until you prove to me evolution, by God, I'm going to believe in the Rock of Ages, in the Bible, right?
Well, that was the bombast from Bryan. Of course, Darrow had his own bombast.
He was an agnostic.
He was a crusading agnostic who truly believed in the depth of his heart that revealed religion was the worst thing in the world, that it caused all the hate and all the war and all the violence, and he wanted to root religion out of public society because that's what caused the problems, and he believed that with the depth of his heart as strongly as Bryan believed that God was love. Darrow believed that religion was hate.
And even though it maybe didn't matter in terms of the outcome, an issue that is still resonating today, and what that was about was, how do you believe we got here? Did we evolve from a single-celled organism, or did God create us in a very divine way? Where are you on that debate?
Where am I on that? Oh, well, I believe in evolution myself, but I love this the resonance of this debate, because it does reach down to something that's very profound, because our own view of origins really has a large impact on who we are and our view of ourselves, and that's what was at stake here.
Maybe it's a minor point, but I just thought it was really interesting as they were having this argument. Brian said words to the effect in the trial as it was reenacted last night that even if I concede to you that we evolved from a single-cell organism, tell me when we became immortal then. I mean, we're all here, and maybe we did evolve, but then how did we, because even an evolutionist would probably concede that we are special and that maybe we are even God's children. Okay, then, Mr. Evolutionist, when did we get on board? When did God in the evolutionary train invite us on? That's a tough question to answer.
Well, that's where Darrow would have broke with him, and that was the down-deep issue, because Brian didn't mind about evolution itself. What he cared about was naturalism, and what Darrow wanted was that was God nowhere in the process, that it was a purely natural process. And down deep, he was pushing that avenue. Brian actually believed in evolution of everything but humans, and he didn't mind the Catholic view that humans evolved from apes and then God breathed the soul in. What Darrow wanted to get rid of was the soul.
Let's pause for a minute. That man who's speaking with us now, Edward J. Larson, is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize in History a couple of years ago for his book, Summer for the Gods. When we come back, Ann, my friend at the station, is going to do a little traffic, and we'll do a couple commercials. Talk to us a little bit about the broadcast and the historic relevance that this radio station played in all of that, and then the media coverage, if you will.
Now, Monkey See, Monkey Do, Talk.
It's the 75th anniversary of the Scopes trial.
We now return to the John Burton Show, live from Dayton, Tennessee.
A buzzer took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzer tried to throw the monkey off his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right."
Oh, we flew all right. We flew down to Chattanooga, Tennessee. That was nice and fun and easy. We took the 30-minute ride north of Chattanooga to Dayton, Tennessee. It's Ray County. We're in front of the courthouse here, the historic courthouse where the Scopes monkey trial took place 75 years ago this week. And William Jennings Bryan died 5 days after the verdict was read. Amazing history. And WGN Radio is part of it. This is John Williams. My producer, Matt Bubala, is here sitting right beside me. And our engineer, James Lucas, is watching the dials. And we've been talking with various players in the show, with people whose ancestors were part of it. And now with Edward J. Larson, who was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago in history. He wrote about this event. So you maybe more than any of us know a little bit about the media and the broadcasting of this. Talk about WGN Radio's role.
This was the most sensational trial of a sensation-loving decade. The decades were sort of like this decade, the 90s, in loving sensations and loving celebrities. And Brian and Darrow were two of the greatest celebrities. Of course, Clarence Darrow lived in Chicago. Brian was from Illinois, Salem, Illinois. And this trial caught the nation's attention in that hot summer of 1925, when there really wasn't that much happening anyway. The press dubbed it as the trial of the century before it even began, as these two lions duked it out. And WGN was right in the middle of it because the Chicago Tribune was in the middle of it. The Chicago Tribune had always despised William Jennings Bryan because he was a progressive Democrat and they were the conservative Republican paper of the Midwest. And here was a chance to just gruel him. They had attacked him throughout his career. He was still a very active politician. And here was a chance to nail him. And they covered the whole anti-evolution crusade and then this budding trial. And then when their own homegrown Clarence Darrow, the greatest trial lawyer in America, probably greatest criminal lawyer ever, decided to take him on, that was going to be news.
It was a perfect marriage then of the new radio station with the best attorney in town going down to do battle against the guy we don't like. Maybe that explains why Quinn Ryan, the broadcaster, described Brian's head on the radio. Do you remember the quote? He described him in the courtroom in his bald pate as like a sunrise coming up over the the over Key West, yeah.
And another time he compared it to a cantaloupe and a melon. He was having a great time. He knew exactly the angle he was to take. Now, it was really revolutionary. It was being covered by the news media very, very closely, and all the major papers had something here. Telegraph wires were strung, over 100,000 telegraph miles of telegraph wire were strung in here so they could bring sort of ticker tape it out, like the baseball games were. But WGN had a better idea. They hung a radio line all the way from Chicago to Dayton. They hung it for the trial.
Wait a minute. I thought that we were just buying the use of existing AT&T cable.
Parts of it they had to hang themselves.
No kidding.
Yeah, there were parts in Indiana where they had to connect through to make it a straighter line, and they made a mistake. They put in three microphones. Now, we know now they should have only put in one. It caused a clashing sound because they were getting the voices from three microphones. But nothing like this had ever been broadcast. The only thing similar was the year before they broadcast the national political conventions for the first time. That was the model. But to put them where they thought they needed them, they had to, and this was a great, I think just a great vignette, they had to move the jury box from in the center, put it over on the side to put the microphones in. That just shows the media taking over from the theoretical deciders, the jury. Imagine the media knocking out the jury. I just think that's a telltale for this event. And there were three microphones right in the center.
Kind of a metaphor for what has happened ever since, the media invading every aspect of our lives, literally pushing the jury to the side.
And in addition to, of course, it being broadcast, and not only, it went up to Chicago, but WGN had a hookup. They had a relatively stronger station then because there was no competition.
The signal, you mean?
The signal. You could hear them further. And they hooked up so it was picked up other places. So they advertised coast-to-coast coverage, that this could be heard across the country over radio. Now, there were only a few stations then, and the paper had in its, I've read several articles in the Tribune, they had to defend the notion of a broadcast trial. No trials had ever been broadcast, and they thought back then you couldn't even take photographs in a courtroom, and why can you broadcast this? Courts are sort of sacrosanct. And what they explained, the head of the WGN and also the editor of the Tribune and the judge here, was this isn't a real trial. This is a media event. This is a debate. They called it a summer Chautauqua, which was a term back then for a debate or a lecture about the merits of on evolutionary teaching and on the role of a revealed religion.
I think it was interesting, too, some of the ethics, if you will, that were, by even today's standards, a little questionable. For instance, the media going after a figure they don't like. The fee for Darryl was paid, was it not, by one of the newspapers out east?
Well, that's the story. That's the way it's put in Inherit the Wind. But actually, Clarence Darrow cared so much about this case, so much about the chance to attack Brian and to bait the fundamentalist, that he volunteered his legal services. The only time in his entire life he ever volunteered his legal services, he was then getting $250,000 a case. And he volunteered his service for this, came down on his own nickel, and handled the case.
I heard that back then there were as few as just 100,000 radio receivers in the Chicago area.
Right.
So people were probably all gathered around the radios listening to this event. I have a sense of the history of it just coming through the box and people being thrilled by those distant voices. Was there some of that back then too?
Very much indeed. It was an event that captured the nation's attention, and there hadn't been such an exciting event, except maybe the conventions of a couple years before, or the year before, where really the radio showed its power to, with intimacy, bringing us a historical event. And that, you can read many people who write back that they understood for the first time the power of media, and it was because of WGN.
This is all told in a book called Summer for the Gods. It's the 1998 Pulitzer Prize-winning book of history. It's the Scopes Trial and America's continuing debate over science and religion. And Edward J. Larson is the man who wrote the story and is going to give a symposium here that will be broadcast on C-SPAN on Saturday, tomorrow. Congratulations again. You're a great storyteller. I hope we can visit with you again sometime.
Thank you much. It's great to have you down here.
You bet. Radio 720 WGN Radio's John Williams Show from a remote location. You couldn't get farther away from Chicago if you tried, in a way. We are in a small town of 5,000 people in eastern Tennessee, sitting on the lawn in front of the Ray County Courthouse, where 75 years ago this week, the Scopes Monkey Trial took place, and WGN Radio made history by being the first radio station to broadcast the live proceedings of a courtroom. And of course, it wasn't just any proceedings, but events so important, so exciting and thrilling that the whole world listened and watched and waited to hear. Even the combatants in the courtroom would say, "I want the world to hear this." And they knew well that there were four microphones from our radio station placed around the courtroom. They reenact that event every year in a festival up in the courtroom. The same chairs, the same bench, the same courtroom are still there today. Rick Dye is a man who sort of alerted us to some of this and in some ways invited us down and said, "Will you come down and be part of it again?" And we thought, you know, that we, I think, too often, too easily forget our history. And so let's not. Let's sort of retell some of this story. So that's why we're here. Rick, thank you for kind of inviting us down.
Well, we're very glad to have you. And as a matter of fact, probably the pinnacle of the trial was the examination of William Jennings Bryan by Clarence Darrow. And as a matter of fact, as we made you aware, that day the proceedings were moved out onto the courthouse lawn due to the excessive heat and the overcrowding in the courtroom. So where you're sitting, John, is just a matter of about 20 feet from where the bench stood that Bryan was examined on that famous day in 1925.
What a bizarre twist that is. I mean, okay, let me just sort of remind everybody who the players are. You've got William Jennings Bryan, who is arguing for the state, if you will, that we should uphold the law in Tennessee, which says that you cannot teach evolution, essentially. And down from Chicago, here comes Clarence Darrow, that carpetbagger who's sort of come to town to save the day for this John Scopes character. At least in a way, that's the way it's portrayed. But you've got these two great combatants, correct?
All being narrated by people like Quinn Ryan and, of course, H.L. Mencken, who was one of the great instigators in getting
right.
Darrow involved.
And the point is that, so you have these two attorneys on each side, and one of them calls the other up onto the stand. It would be as if Marsha Clark put Johnny Cochran up on the stage, on the stand, and asked him to testify. They didn't even know if you could do that. And then if so, how do you do that? But they did, right?
It was an unprecedented event. It was the first time that it had ever taken place in a trial, and it is still studied and discussed and debated in law schools today.
If you can do that and how they handled it. And I mean, really, that's what you want. I mean, wouldn't it have been great if you could have just seen them drop the gloves at the O.J. trial or at any great event like that, and instead of working through a judge or working through a talk show host or procedures, just say, no, let's let the two of you guys have a conversation in front of everybody so the two great minds have it out.
The amazing thing about it is Darrow planned this strategy when he realized he was not going to get any expert testimony in. So his position was, if he could get Bryan on the stand and open up the door of interpretation of the Bible instead of literal acceptance, that way he might edge in the arguments of evolution. In other words, present that it was a process as opposed to just this thing that happened on its own. And leaving out the point whether God was the initial spark or not, just allowing the evolution argument a doorway.
Let's make that point clear, too. So there's this guy, John Scopes, who's using the biology textbook in your local high school. And in there they teach evolution. They had just passed a law in Tennessee that said you cannot teach evolution, correct?
That's correct.
So in a way they were looking for a trial case, too, weren't they? They said, well, let's see what happens when we test that in court, correct?
Well, to step back just a little bit, the ACLU had been following what was going on in the Tennessee legislature, and it was discussed in other states. It was discussed in Kentucky as a neighboring state. But this had been going on in a number of states. Bryan had been in Tennessee lobbying for this law, making speeches. When the law passed, the ACLU immediately got involved and began searching for a teacher to challenge the law. And, of course, their mission was to try to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and challenge the constitutionality.
But you watch Inherit the Wind, and you've got this, you know, earnest teacher teaching good science in front of a classroom when the federales show up. and marshal him out. It didn't happen that way at all.
Not at all. In fact, Scopes, even in his own memoirs, although he remembered substituting in the biology class for a period of about 2 weeks, and that's the best we can document historically, he was not the regular biology teacher. He was, in fact, the regular mathematics teacher.
Huh.
He substituted in the class, and even in his own memoirs, Center of the Storm, he couldn't recall the material that he covered. He covered whatever the regular teacher left for him and went over prepared material, and in fact, in the trial, was not able to take the stand to testify because of one, he could, the first question he'd be asked, did you teach this? And then that opens up the issues of perjury and what have you. So Scopes never took the trial, and in fact, his only participation were his closing remarks.
But the whole thing then was almost a foregone conclusion. I mean, it's not like... Again, it takes away, in a way, doesn't it, the genuineness of the battle. While both sides may have felt strongly about their issues, and they did, it was almost, let's go find this guy. Hey, Scopes, can we use you as a model case? Okay, sure. Well, let's all meet in the courtroom and let's have it out. And then it became a floor for the attorneys and the two, academic positions, if you will. In fact, if I understand the story correctly... all of a sudden I lost my point here.
Let's say it this way. Now, here's John Scopes. He's just out of college. He'd graduated the previous year from the University of Kentucky. This was his first teaching job. He had just finished his first year at Ray Central High School. Along comes his boss, chairman of the school board,
yeah,
who's one of the instigators of this event, and the principal and superintendent of schools, Walter White. They call him to a meeting. They present these issues to him, and he basically says, well, I agree with you. If this is the law and this is the textbook, you can't teach this textbook without violating the law.
Okay, so and now you remind me of my point then. So they were so interested in finding an opportunity to have this out in court that they go into the court, they have the trial, but when it comes time for the verdict, Scopes' attorney himself, Darryl, correct? He wants a guilty verdict, right?
He asked for the guilty verdict when he realized that all of his expert testimony had been excluded. The judge had excluded all of it, so the best thing to do was go ahead, ask for the verdict, get the conviction, and move on to the appellate level.
So Darryl wants him, or Brian, the prosecution, they want to find him guilty. They're the ones that brought him to the court. And now his own attorney, Brian wanted him found guilty. Darryl, his own attorney, says, look, go ahead, find us guilty. Let's just move on. He was conceding this round, in other words.
Absolutely.
And then it does go on to the appellate or Supreme Court.
It goes on to the appellate level. The unfortunate part is they were not able to appeal on any of the elements, constitutional elements of the law. What they ended up winning the appeal on was a simple procedural technicality. The judge imposed the fine, and under the statute, the fine was supposed to be imposed by the jury.
So after all of that...
So the Tennessee appellate courts used this as a quick out to settle the issue, overturn the conviction, and get rid of the case.
And they wrote it in a way that said, and let's not hear any more of this, right?
Absolutely. They sent a definite message to the attorney generals throughout the state of Tennessee, we don't want to see this issue again.
It's good to see you down here. We're in front of the county courthouse where you've spent many of your hours lately, but everything's been going so well. Congratulations on putting on a very interesting event.
Well, and we thank you very much for coming back and celebrating this very special anniversary with us.
It's interesting. It's a man named Rick Dye. Let's pause. We'll get into the WGN Radio newsroom in a minute.
And now, the indisputable proof that some of us really did evolve from monkeys.
It's the 75th anniversary of the Scopes trial.
Here's John Williams.
I resemble that remark. I am on the Ray County courthouse lawn, just literally 20 feet away from the corner of the building, and just down the way, William Jennings Bryan debated Clarence Darrow in the famous last day of the trial. It was almost a debate between the two of you right out here when it was too hot, correct?
That's correct.
I mean, it was bizarre. He called you up onto the stand and asked you to testify, right?
Well, truth be known, I think Clarence had this plan. That's my personal opinion. I cannot prove that, but some years prior to the trial, he had actually written a letter to the Chicago Tribune. And in this letter, he listed a number of questions that he would pose to me and to other creationists and begged for an answer. I did not dignify his letter with that answer, but many of those questions showed up again during the cross.
So then he puts you up on the stand, he gets to grill you, he makes his great speech, and then you wanted to turn to do the same, and you were denied that. You didn't get a chance to give your great closing speech, did you?
That is true. He requested that the judge instruct the jury to bring in a guilty verdict, which the judge did, and the jury did. And
so they didn't need your closing argument?
No closing argument.
And yet you had a great effort, written a many thousand word speech. You were going to go on, weren't you?
Yes, and that speech is published and available in your bookstores.
How long would it have taken you to deliver?
Better part of a day and a half, I imagine. Well, now, Mr. Darrow took 3 days to close in the Leopold and Loeb case.
A day and a half you were going to go on?
Oh, easily.
And you wrote that thing and they didn't let you deliver it. That must have broke your little heart.
I never got an opportunity to deliver that speech. The final message.
And in fact, you not ever got a chance because you died 5 days later, right? After the end of the trial.
That's correct. Fortunately, I did preview the speech that very day.
Oh, no kidding. So you did spend the day and a half or the full day reading it to an audience?
I had previewed it to an audience. We were not finished with the composition in any way, shape, or form. But it was...
How did it go? Did they like it? Was
they loved it.
Yeah, they did. Well, I loved what I saw in the courthouse last night. And I don't know what you would say, but if you were going to give again our audience listening now a sense of the history and the debate, what should we remember about this?
Perhaps his summation regarding the media.
What did he say?
Dayton is the center and seat of this trial largely due to circumstance. We have been told that more words have been sent across the ocean to Australia and to Europe about this trial than have ever been sent across the ocean by cable before regarding anything happening in the United States. This is not because the trial took place in Dayton. Rather, I think it illustrates how people can be drawn into prominence by associating themselves with great causes. Causes stir the world. They reach far and extend beyond man's capability to see. Here has been fought out a little case of little consequence as a case, but the world has been interested because it raised an issue, and that issue will one day be settled for the right, be it settled on our side or the other.
Wow. So you didn't... Now he's taking a bow now and tipping his hat to the crowd, as you might expect him. So you didn't concede, you did not, you sort of conceded that perhaps history will prove you wrong? Is that what you're saying at the end of that speech?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I did indicate that history would settle the case right.
Yeah. You look terrific, by the way, having been dead
now. I feel good.
Having been away for 75 years, how old were you when you died? You were a young man by today's standards, were you
not? Mid-60s, 63. Clarence was older than me.
I see. Well, you
still
have to point that out. Well, congratulations on what is great theater, great drama, great history, and making it matter to people again, giving us a real sense of what the event was all about.
And the event and the issue still matters as well.
Yeah.
And nice, we thank you for your helping us to get the word out to the people.
Okay, now, end of character. What's your real name?
My real name is T.J. Gill.
And where are you from?
St. Petersburg, Florida.
You're an academic, you're a thespian, you're an actor by trade.
Yeah, actually, we do our share of acting. A little bit of a career change for me. My wife and I just bought a bed and breakfast in Madeira Beach, Florida.
Wow, what's the name of that?
It's called Snug Harbor Inn.
Folks, when you go to Madeira Beach, go to Snug Harbor Inn and ask to speak to William Jennings Bryan.
He'll be there.
No kidding. Nice to meet you. Thanks for saying hello
to
us.
My pleasure, John.
Wow, amazing. The familiar tones of the John Williams True-False game. Remember now, boys and girls, here's how it works. You get Ann, you get Dave, you get me, three true-false questions. But just for being the fifth caller, Joe, are you there? How are you?
Good, how are you?
You're on WGN Radio. You just won a Scopes Monkey Trial prize package.
Well, how about that?
Souvenir T-shirt, souvenir monkey. Ready to play?
I'm ready to play.
You got Ann and Dave to help you out. True or false? One of the attorneys in this case was Sue Hicks. He was named after his mother who died during childbirth. Sue Hicks was the inspiration for the Johnny Cash song, A Boy Named Sue. True or false?
I'm going to have some help here.
Okay.
How about Ann?
What do you think of that, Ms. Maxfield?
I'd say that again because management was in here.
One of the attorneys in the Scopes Monkey trial was named Sue Hicks.
Right.
He was named after his mother who died during childbirth. Sue Hicks was the inspiration for Johnny Cash's song, A Boy Named Sue.
I'll say that's true.
Oh, she sounded confident. I'll go with that.
And where do you get off being so confident about this, Ann?
I'm not confident at all, but it sounds like a logical story and too convoluted for you to make up.
It's true.
Hey, how about that? Levels. Thanks, Ann.
I just have to read your mind. That's
true
all.
Or false? Okay, you're on a groove.
Thanks.
True or false, William Jennings Bryant's... You remember William Jennings Bryant was the attorney for the prosecution in the case. He said that they ought to teach creation, not evolution, if you will. William Jennings Bryant's son married Clarence Darrow's daughter. Clarence Darrow was for the defense. But their sons and daughters got together down here, and they later became man and wife. True or false?
Ooh, that one's kind of sneaky, but I'm going to say true on that one.
Now remember, if at any point during the true-false game you're not completely certain with your answer, you can always go to Dave Stewart or Ann Maxfield for some help.
Okay, well, I thought I'd go a little help here. Maybe Dave knows this one.
Yeah, but maybe he doesn't. that sounds too O. Henry to be true, I think.
Well, I might. I can change my answer, can't I?
Joe's answer is...
I'll go false.
That's false. Finally, this is for the whole enchilada, true or false, William Jennings Bryan, remember, three-time presidential candidate, former Secretary of State, spoke at a high school graduation in Salem, Illinois in 1917, and one of the boys in the audience who created a ruckus and actually disturbed his speech would reunite with him years later, because that boy who was in that high school graduating class was John Scopes, the man who would be later tried in the Scopes Monkey Trial.
Okay, wow. Paul Harvey.
I know, that's so rest of the story, is
totally
that
totally, especially
well,
the way you phrased it.
True or false?
The way you phrased it, I'll say true.
What do you think of that one, Ann?
I'll say true.
Dave?
I like it. Let's call it true.
It's true.
Yeah.
Holy
right.
How about that?
Joe,
wow.
You rock, babe.
Thanks, guys.
Congratulations. You've just won a Scopes Monkey Trial party pack. And also, we're going to send you over to Ron Sano's, number 10 restaurant in Park Ridge, okay?
That sounds great.